Okay. Hi, Danny. How you doing? I guess that's Danny. Okay. So, hit me, dealer, whenever you're ready. Okay. Well, this is Hunt Tooley, and this is the Ludwig von Mises Institute, the Mises Academy, and our course this time around is the Interwar Years, a history of the world between the wars, and we're on our number five episode of all this. So glad to have you with us. Those of you who are present now, really happy about that, and you helped make it possible for the thing to go out with some spontaneity to people see it who see it later on. So thanks for both groups. I'm happy you are both taking it. I'm happy you're all taking it. I got a lot of the papers graded and looked at and marked over the weekend, and you wrote some great stuff. Really interesting. A lot of you are excellent writers and good analysts of all this. So good job. And if you didn't do a good job, then you didn't get a good grade, and you'll know who you are. Most got a good grade. Just remember to get as much of those readings in there and little bits and pieces. And as Tanzel says, and as Mises says, a lot of you do that already, but some who are not quite up at the top could improve by kind of nailing it down like that. So that's about the only comment I've got on those. A good job, and I enjoyed reading. Well, this week, what we do is move into the 30s. We'll start in the 20s. We'll start with we talk about the Depression this week, and we'll be talking about it. We've already talked about it, kind of run up to it last week, and we'll deal with some aspects of it this week, and then again some next week. It's a huge event, and it's not just an American event. It's a Great Depression that goes pretty much all over the world. So the way we'll do that is to talk first about the totalitarians and their consolidation of power, then specifically about the Depression, then specifically about aggression in the 1930s in particular, and finally about FDR with some concentrated remarks and concentrated aspects of his policy, both domestic and foreign, and then we'll be done. I'm going to try to finish up a little bit earlier than I have been because I've left some questions. For example, where we're going to talk about Hitler, but some of you have had even a couple of my courses that dealt in one way or the other with Hitler, and so I thought it'd be best to leave basic and complex questions about Hitler to the end, and I've also left some questions about FDR for the end, so I don't go into that as fully as we might do it because I think we all know a lot about him, and I hate to just state the obvious, but that way we can kind of just answer questions at the end. So without further ado, let's plunge into the totalitarians and their consolidation of power. There's some quasi-totalitarians, but of course these are the three big ones. And what I've done is to make a kind of I don't know, a kind of concordance of murder, mayhem, statism, totalitarianism. And I just want to talk through this fairly rapidly. It goes on to a couple more slides. One thing about these guys is that they were all marginal in some way. Stalin, of course, was a Georgian as opposed to a Russian. Mussolini was from northern Italy, but his father was a syndicalist, an extreme syndicalist anarchist activist. So that put him on a kind of periphery of society, I suppose. Hitler was on several peripheries. He was an Austrian, and he was actually from the Austrian-German border region, and his situation was that his father was also somebody kind of on the peripheries, an army sergeant who had been given a little sinecure for collecting tolls and kind of was raised up a bit in the social scale. And then Hitler was born in Linz and went to this indifferent school and didn't do well. And it was an outsider in many ways. And there may be other ways that we could talk about that too. But in any case, these three people were not they were not necessarily the types to be the in crowd in your high school. If everybody knows what that means, maybe that's a early American reference. But I don't think they're going to be in anybody's social register invitation list. But they were certainly they all had something in common. They all had these personalities that were dominating, and they dominated the others around them. And they talked, and others listened. And as they gained more and more power, others learned to listen even more closely. They all had sharp elbows and were able to elbow everybody out of the side and get to the top of their organization, take it over. They all had in common the ideas of centralization of power, the idea of the super state, the total war state. They were all involved in World War I in some form or fashion. And they all took the lessons of World War I and the wars surrounding it that we talked about last week, and said that war state was actually a great thing, a wonderful thing to strive for the future, and that would be the way the utopia, whichever one they happened to espouse, would in fact be put in place. So. We have three people who are strikingly similar. We have comments among the three, especially Hitler and Stalin, of sort of grudging admiration as they took care of various dissidents and whatnot. And Hitler would have a good laugh about Stalin's execution of his enemies, and Stalin makes a little joke about Hitler's knife, the long knife, that type of thing. So they're a kind of club, although they weren't, let's say, close. The first one to take power was, of course, Mussolini, who came to power in 1922. His fascist party had come to power in a kind of show of street violence, and Mussolini took power as prime minister with the king still in place. And to tell you the truth, he never really displaced the king. He displaced the constitution, the government, and so forth, but he did not displace the system of monarchy. Gradually took more and more powers to himself. It took him several years, as we'll see, to kind of make a party state out of it. But he's the first. He's the kind of elder statesman of these in that sense. Although, to tell you the truth, Stalin is not far behind. By 1922, he's already maneuvering to become the head. But remember, Lenin doesn't die until 1924. And then it takes a couple of years for Stalin to really get going. Hitler is the farthest behind. He has the most ground to make up. He's got the least organization, the least experience, the least of anything, the least expectations. He's in a way the most marginal of them. And so what Hitler does is to leap in, take over this small group. We talked about this last time, the German Workers' Party, and really punch it into shape. But then he's got Stalin and Mussolini to kind of, rather Lenin and Mussolini to kind of follow after, in particular Mussolini. And many of the aspects of the DAP that Hitler changed into the NS, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, many of those aspects he took directly from Mussolini. The uniforms, the parades, a lot of the mysticism of hypernationalism and so forth and so on. So in any case, Hitler tries to take over in 23, but this is too soon. It was the Bierhall Putsch, and that's a coup attempt against the government of Bavaria. He failed. But meanwhile, over in Russia in 1924, Lenin finally died, and Stalin starts his maneuvering against Trotsky and others. Meanwhile, Mussolini's been reigning for 2 years. Hitler spent the year of 24 in a very comfy house arrest in Bavaria, while Stalin is preparing to take over. In fact, in 1925, also Mussolini got to the point where he could set up a one-party state and all the other parties and say, we now have a fascist state. And in that sense, then he says, there's no need for me to be prime minister anymore or have the title of prime minister. It's fine to have a title. But what I'd rather be called is much more simply, much more directly, Il Duce, the leader. I just want to be the leader. And so he adopted that title. It's going to take a couple of years before Stalin gets to the point where he can call himself Vozhd, V-O-Z-H-D, Vozhd, and that means, well, the leader, all right? And then it's not going to be until 1934, nearly 10 years later, when Hitler is able to become both president and prime minister of Germany, and he will say, I don't want these silly political parliamentary titles. I just want to be called the leader, right? So he adopts the same form of address in the form of Der Führer, which means the leader. So if we move on to the next little chart, by 1927, Stalin is ensconced in power, and he's already thinking about how to carry out forced collectivization of the countryside. The cities were already collectivized, already socialized, but the countryside's had a little bit of play in it still, although for the most part it had already been taken over. In Italy, Mussolini moves forward with what his radical followers called the Second Revolution in 1927-28. So he's excluded the parties. He's put the Constitution out of effect. He's ruling practically by decree. And he is about to radicalize, especially in favor of his leftward-leaning fascist members, and start confiscating especially some of the bigger estates and some of the bigger factories. And when, in fact, he makes a kind of right turn, and he reconciles with the church. That is to say, Italy and the Roman Church have been at odds ever since the Revolution of 1848, and more importantly, the unification of Italy in 1862. So they had been at each other's sort of, agree to disagree and not in sync with each other since then. And Mussolini began a move that eventually led to what we call the Lateran Pact, which got Italy back together with the church. And this was a signal to most people in Italy, his father was this radical atheist syndicalist guy, and he himself was a socialist and a syndicalist and then a radical atheist nationalist, but maybe not all that bad. And it's also true that at that time he veers much more into a kind of crony capitalism, and he creates this whole doctrine of corporatism. The historians use the term corporatism in a number of different ways, and we've used it actually several different ways in this course. But Mussolini's corporatism is something he got from some historians of medieval Europe who talked about how that there were these all the different groups in Europe were the bodies or the corpora of Europe, and that that it's the job of the king to or the job of any ruler to kind of mediate among these corpora. Well, Mussolini had this idea of the state, as the be-all and end-all of the world, and he invented the term totalitarianism. But what he adopts in the 30s is this sort of medieval corporatism. He uses it as a kind of divide and rule tactic, because if all society is divided up into large employers, small employees, large employee groups, workers, and then factory owners, and then the countryside workers, and the countryside owners, and the shoemakers and cobblers and whatnot. Your cobblers, same thing. So, but handicrafts and these things. So all these, he says, are bodies, and they all have different interests. And it's the job of the state merely to be the referee to make sure that society it works for the good of all these corpora. And that's where that's how he used that word corporatism. And he develops it in this period, and then he starts in much more intensively. Had always been at this a little, but much more intensively with the crony capitalism. So that the big companies gobble up the little ones with government help, and then they do the government's bidding, and there's government intervention and huge profit for both, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where Mussolini goes. This is his most intensive period of work. He was not, strangely, for as far as he went, he was not an intensively hard worker. My PhD mentor, Hans Schmidt, used to say, how do you like that? Here's a guy whose first real paying job in his life was Chancellor of Germany. But he did work hard in the campaigns from the late 20s to January 1933, when he then became chancellor. And he worked hard strategizing. He worked hard giving speeches. He worked hard getting out and about. He worked hard planning and working with others. So he was, in fact, the thing about it is the Weimar Republic didn't have that many good politicians. I talked about Gustav Stresemann last week. He died in his 50s in 1930. There were some other pretty good politicians who also happened to die young. And I'm not talking about foul play or anything. They just had heart attacks or something. In a sense, it's also the truth that the Nazi Party, taking some ideas from the Italian fascists, some ideas from American politics, some ideas that they had on their own. They were a lot, the party had some smart people working for it. And they were the most forward-thinking party. They were the ones who got into precinct targeting. They'd say, well, Cologne is a workers' city, but, if we work on these precincts and turn those workers there, maybe we can get the whole district. That type of thing that is just, the common coin of politics in America and most places. The Nazi Party was doing it when no other party was. They were using the media when nobody else was. That's why there's all this film of Hitler, because he had everything he did filmed. They had mobile movies. They would have vans go around with a screen on the side and show movies to crowds. Hitler was on the radio all the time, every time he could get on it. He had the party rally filmed. Everybody knows that. It became that movie, Triumph of the Will. And so he was one of the great media manipulators. Indeed, if you think about it, it's Roosevelt gets into power, and he's at that point he's borrowing from Hitler. Now, Hitler's going to borrow from other people, but once Roosevelt gets on, it's clear that you can use the radio and the movies, the electronic media that existed. It's clear that you could use those as a way to political power, and Hitler certainly did that. Stalin is is out of this race. I mean, he doesn't really need the radio. And to tell you the truth, he was not a good media personality. He just didn't. He could speak. I mean, we have speeches from Stalin, but they're pretty dusty. I mean, he's no as my friend used to say, he was okay, but he's no Buddy Hackett. We were always joking about how many times Buddy Hackett would appear on the Tonight Show. I didn't watch it, but my friend did, and he was laughing about that. So he compared everybody to Buddy Hackett. So anyway, Hitler became chancellor. Before Hitler became chancellor, he follows Mussolini a little bit, veering into a more respectable path. In 1931, he gave a speech before the Dusseldorf Industrieclub, the industry club, and that signaled to his old radical workers that Hitler had kind of betrayed the left wing of the movement, and there was a strong left wing kind of socialist, violent, quasi-syndicalist part of the party. They too were anti-Semitic. They too were, hyper-nationalist and all that, but they were leftish in orientation. And indeed, Hitler's only real pal in the party, Ernst Röhm, the head of the Brown Shirts, the SA, he was the leader of a faction of leftward leaning radicalizing Nazis, as were the Strasser brothers of a very different one. So there was more than one constituency within the party. And when Hitler veered into kind of more respectable avenues, he even wore a suit on that occasion, which made all the old party fighters furious. But he began more and more to make these, as he got closer and closer to having enough votes to get into power, he courted the industries much more, and then eventually would establish, even before he was in power, establish these ties that would create crony capitalism with contracts, huge government contracts for rearmament, for synthetic fuel, for all kinds of things. So Hitler is in a way kind of threading the needle here and moving in the path that Mussolini does. We have big doings in 1934. Hitler's in power from 1933, makes it a one-party state, quick, easy. By the summer, it wasn't easy, I'm kidding, but by the summer, all the parties are gone. It's just the Nazi Party. And it's then that Ernst Röhm, his kind of rival and friend in the party, then makes this play a bit of a play for power, wanting to take over the army. Hitler used the long knives. All Nazi organizations had daggers. The postmen had daggers. Everybody in the Third Reich had a ceremonial dagger. And the SS dagger was long, and SA, the stormtrooper dagger, was short. So it was the night of the long knives, the night when the SS defeated the SA. That was in the late summer of 1934, about the time Hindenburg died, about the time that Hitler took over as Führer. So by 1934, Hitler's totally in power. Stalin is thoroughly ensconced in power by 1934 also, and the murder of Sergei Kirov marked the beginning of the great purges that went on through the 30s. Strangely, at this point, Mussolini is opposed to Hitler, because one of the early moves of the Nazis was to try to stir up by assassination. They assassinated the Austrian chancellor, and they tried to stir up Austria so that Germany would have to step in, and then they would reunite in Anschluss. Well, Mussolini didn't want Germany coming right up to his border, and so he mobilized the troops to the Brenner Pass, ready to go in and stop the German army should they come in. That was in 1934. And so Mussolini, for several years, a couple of years anyway, was actually an opponent of Hitler's. We'll talk about that just a little bit more later. 1935, what happens in Italy is the invasion of Ethiopia. We'll talk about that more later. In 1935, now Hitler is able to to start revising the treaty. He carries out the plebiscite in the Saarland and starts planning how to take back all these things that were taken away in the treaty. And then, of course, starts the real anti-Semitic policies in the form of the Nuremberg Laws and so forth. And we're kind of getting almost outside of our range, but I want to go this far and a little bit more for this class. Intervention in the Spanish Civil War. I mean, all three of these powers intervene, but they're on different sides. The Germans and the Italians intervene in favor of Franco and the Nationalists. The Soviets, of course, intervene on the side of the loyalists or socialists / communists / the left of whatever kind. So in 1937, the most intensive time of the purges begins in Russia. In Italy, the Civil War has kind of brought Italy and Germany together. And so Italy signs on with Germany and Japan in the anti-Comintern, an anti-Soviet pact. And then, of course, the Munich crisis comes. We're on our way to war in the late 30s. Anschluss with Austria happened. Mussolini's fully on the side of Hitler, and by now he's been almost at a point where he's about to become the junior partner in all of that. And then in 1939, of course, Stalin negotiates the non-aggression pact, or has Molotov negotiate the non-aggression pact with the Germans, and the war starts on September 1st, and the Soviets, with the German invasion of Poland, the Soviets invade Poland on September 17th. Italy stays clear of the war for a few months, quite a few months, and then gets in. That's the concordance there. Let me make some comments on these sweeping and fast events. I want to say this. Mussolini was a statist, a corporatist, personally quite a racist. Not the kind of racist you might think. I mean, he didn't like, he was racial when it came to Jews, like a little bit like his Roman forebears. It's not so much color that he worried about. It was another kind of lesser peoples. But he was pretty much, thought that there were plenty of those around who, were useless eaters and that type of thing. He certainly invented the whole totalitarian ideology. And, I should back up and say that he didn't really inject many of these racist ideas. There was no anti-Semitic policy in Italy until the war started and until he found himself kind of pinned down and having to, under Hitler's pressure, start rounding up Jews in Italy. So I need to back up and say that. In other words, during the span of fascist Italy from 22 to 1940, there's really no coherent sort of anti-Semitic program or something like that. He invented the whole totalitarian ideology. He's the one who said, without the state, nothing. Before the state, nothing. The state is everything. All these different little quotations you can find on the Brainy quote, Mussolini quotation page, if you want. But he was not the killer that Stalin and Hitler were. These guys were just mass murderers. Not that the fascists didn't kill some people. These squadristi, these hit squads, these kind of the equivalent to the brown shirts in Italy, they were really vocal left-wing proponents of syndicalist-type, anarcho-syndicalist-type violence along the lines of Georges Sorel in France. And we studied that before in the totalitarians course. Some of you may remember that. But, they thought violence was a good thing. And you kind of that feeling kind of moves into other groups in the 20th century too, but these squadristi kind of, they thought it was great to kill people. That way you kind of made a point. They thought it was kind of a cleansing thing to have a lot of violence. And so they did kill, hundreds of people in street fights and local squabbles and murders, and they'd be, you know, busting up some opponent's newspaper and shoot them. A famous left of center new type liberal, not a classical liberal, but a kind of social democrat type liberal in Matiote was famously murdered in the streets by squadristi and so forth. And nobody ever had to, you know, come to trial for that. But on the whole, if you count up the folks who were put in, who were arrested for political crimes, for, you know, being against the state, from 1922 to 1940, and then count up the executions, it comes to under 10. Now, I mean, I don't like this state at all. I think it's bad, in spite of the fact that he made the trains run on time. But on the other hand, you just as a comparer, as a historian, you have to just look at this and say, well, there's a difference there. If you're saying Stalin killed his, what, 80 million, 90 million, and Hitler was responsible for this group, that group, the other group, all the, you know, and the war deaths and the civilian deaths and all of it, you know, maybe 8, maybe 9 million total, something like that, then Mussolini just can't play with them at that level. I like the example of Carlo Levi, a famous kind of leftist Italian writer, a little bit like a John Steinbeck or somebody of the Italian literary scene in the 20s and 30s. And Levi was an outspoken critic and wrote all kinds of, published all kinds of, you know, criticisms of the, no, I don't mean Primo Levi, I mean Carlo Levi. Primo Levi was a chemist in the years before he went to Auschwitz. But Carlo Levi, somebody had said that on the list, everybody, I just happened to glance down. Carlo Levi was an outspoken critic. He wrote a little book called Christ Stopped at Eboli, which was an account of the terrible punishment meted out to him for his criticism of the regime and his outspoken opposition to fascism. It was 2 years of exile to southern Italy. Now, I submit to you that a place that most of us would like to go this year to get a little rest and relaxation in a beautiful bucolic setting, that exile to there is not exactly the same as going to the gulag. You see what I mean? So I think we have to, that's one of the comments I want to make on these guys. The most murderous of the three of the totalitarians was Stalin. I mean, I think that you all know that, but it's important to say it because so many people don't. I don't think that the numbers help anybody. I don't think the state should kill anybody, really, you know. But on the other hand, I don't think that it's the same thing when I think you have to look at the enormity of these crimes and say, well, you know, this is not saying Stalin is Hitler's a better person than Stalin or whatever, but you do have to actually judge these things. So let's just say it, that Stalin was the most murderous. There was he was backing up the intentional starvation. He was on the Politburo that Lenin ran that starved a couple million people, 2.5 million people during the Civil War. He went as the great leader of the Soviet Union. Organized the show trials and the enormous expansion of the Gulag system in the mid and late 20s. He then started carrying out forced collectivization on the countryside. And then when there was the tiniest bit of resistance, the war against the kulaks, rounding up everybody who seemed to be the definition of a kulak basically from Stalin was that there were these vicious credit-holding businessmen on the countryside. And the reality was they were anybody who opposed forced collectivization. On the countryside again, after widespread arrests and murders in 1932, there was the beginning of the artificial famine in Ukraine, Belarus, and other, on the Volga and other places, not just Ukraine. Ukraine is kind of taken this on as a special thing, but it happened other places too. Certainly, Ukraine was the main focus of it. In this artificial famine, some 9 or 10 million innocent civilians died, at the very least, possibly more. Those people being dead, Stalin started the Great Purges, which sent hundreds of thousands to the Gulag, many of them to their deaths. And one aspect we often overlook is that from 1935 to 38, some 6 million people were ethnically cleansed in the Soviet Union. That is to say, he would say, I don't think those Koreans are reliable close to that particular border where they live. So we're going to take all of the Soviet citizens who are Koreans and put them on trains. It doesn't matter time of year, doesn't matter whether they have food or not. We'll put them on trains and transport them to maybe, some edge of the Gobi Desert. Or maybe we transport it, not the Gobi, but we transport them to some place in Kazakhstan or somewhere, and just dump them out. The same with Belarus people, and Poles, whom he hated quite intensely. Same with Crimean Tatars and so forth and so on. So in a period of just 4 or 5 years, when it occurred to him that this was the stage to do all this, to kind of neaten up the Soviet borders, he moved about 6 million people. And about 1.5 million of those died, we think. So, it's huge. It's huge. And he was that murderous kind of person. I just glanced down, and I'll look up and try to catch all these good questions. I can't look down all the time, or I would be looking down all the time. But Mike Boyd asked a good question. Why do the numbers vary so much? Well, Mike and everybody, it's hard to know. I mean, a lot of people died without that even being recorded. Moreover, the Russian records were never very good. I mean, Russia was always about two or three generations behind the West in terms of being up to date with bureaucratic things, industrial things, and whatnot. So the records were not that good to begin with. Many of them just kept by, some little village priest or something. So we're not quite sure. A lot of people got away without the Russians knowing where they went. In fact, one argument about lowering numbers of people killed in the artificial famine is that doesn't really take into account a lot of people who escaped. And some people surely did escape. I was privileged when I was in high school to meet a woman who had escaped with her husband and her child in the fog of war. I mean, once the war started, they had just about starved to death, but they managed to make it into Poland. And once the war started, they one way or the other got out. So it's hard to know all this. Numbers are tough. I mean, we have a sense that in America, that we always know how many people are doing what. It may not be as precise as we think, but certainly in other places, it's not as precise. So there is a variation, and you can go look at Rummel's statistics, his democide statistics. They're all online, and you can look at the statistics of others, and they do vary a lot. They all have good reasons, but it's because there are gaps in the record, and we just can't know about it. But it's also always the case that the numbers are affected by emotion and doctrine. And it's also the case that when people want to make one dictator bad, they always say those worst things. So, I mean, as objective historians, you have to guard against these kinds of things. I think objectively, Stalin is the greatest killer, and I think that's pretty clear from the record. So it's that's about all I need to say on that. Comments on Hitler. I think we're going to save, I have a few comments now, and then we'll talk more later. Let me point out that Wikipedia has an entry on Weimar parties and electoral results. I think it's important. People talk about Hitler being elected and coming to power in a legal way, and that was in effect the case. There's this highly illegal part that's going on the streets where Nazi toughs are street fighting and kicking people around. Now, the other parties made militias, too. There got to be a lot of violence in the streets. And the Nazis always said that they thought after the Depression there might be a communist takeover. And, you know, there were Comintern agents working for that, and there were German workers who became communists hoping for a takeover. So that was not quite as far-fetched as it seems. And they fought back oftentimes. So there was blood in the streets. But there were more Nazis than there were. There were more brown shirts and Nazi thugs than there were communists. And so I think they kill more. There were some spectacular murders also carried out, including the famous Potempa murder in summer 1932, in which some brown shirt guys just got drunk one night and decided that this Polish guy in Silesia was probably a communist. And so they just went and kicked him to death. I mean, and this, you know, Hitler owned up to it in a couple of weeks and said, yeah, they did that. It was their patriotic duty to do it because he was a communist. So there's all this violence in the streets. But on the other hand, legally, they were getting the votes. But I do want to point out this, that the, and this is crucial, Hitler got about, nationwide, Germany-wide, in 1924, the last election before 1928, he got about 900,000 votes. That's 1924. Then he works hard. He gets the movie vans going around. He does all the political work I talked about. He does all these things. 1924, 25, 26, he changes plans, various things. They fine-tune the machine. He's working like crazy for the first time in his life, all of that. Everybody's working. Goebbels is making speeches and all that. And they get to 1928, and an election happens. There was the same parliament in Germany for those years, so they didn't have a parliamentary election, federal parliament, the whole one. And then there was a vote. And in that vote, the Nazis had gotten 900,000 before, after all that hard work, got 800,000. You see, in other words, they lost ground. But what happens is, immediately after the Depression hits, then just a year and a half later, there's another vote, and the Nazi total shot up. They don't get the majority. They'll never get the majority. They ended up with about 40 at their highest point before January 1933, about 43%, something like that. And so they had a plurality of the votes. I mean, they had more than more than any of the other parties. And therefore, it was, in fact, customary to invite the leader of that party with the plurality to form a coalition government in those circumstances. So, but I do want to point out, it's the Depression that means that the German political system became radicalized. And the fact that we had eventually 7 million people out of work, that meant that people were going to the stormtrooper soup kitchens and becoming, you know, sort of tools of the party on the one hand, and people were joining the communist cells on the other hand. But again, it's not, we see that in the voting too, that the communists gained a lot too in that same period. But the political system, the middle parties, the liberal party, the DDP split, there was chaos in the middle parties, and they were losing votes. And then the radical edges got more and more radical. So unemployment, there was about, in a country of 66 million, September 1928, 650 million were unemployed. That's already a lot. right? Then September 1929, this is already raising. And look, that's before Black October. What happened then when the stock market crashed in the United States, then and the bank runs and everything that we know, that's the beginning of the Depression here, then all those loans that I talked about actually classed before last. In other words, all those, the Dawes and Young loans and all that Morgan money and everybody else's and all the public American money that had gone to Germany, those banks withcalled the loans. Germany really couldn't pay, but their banks crashed. In Vienna and Berlin and Frankfurt banks, the big ones were collapsing. And so, so the Depression spread immediately to Germany, and then Germany stopped any of its reparation payments to the British and French and Belgians. And so immediately then it kind of, there was that part of the chain reaction that was just kind of automatic. So the Depression, even though it would have made its way around and did make its way around otherwise, in fact, there's this aspect, this close connection of the loans involved that were really important. So that by the time Hitler gets to power, there's about 6.1 million, sometimes people say 7 million, I think the figures are not that clear. And it may be there are a few less by the time he got there. But in any case, that's an important piece of information. And by the way, by the time he gets to 1936, following a program very much, as we'll see, very much parallel to FDR, I'll say this later, but Hitler's basically at zero unemployment. But we'll talk about that later. Let me say something also about the end of the Weimar Republic, and I'm going on too long about all this, but it's all very important. The Depression is crucial. The Weimar Republic was a welfare state with some aspects of a liberal regime that had been preserved. Constitutionally, it had some emergency measures. It was born in the midst of emergency, so they put emergency measures into it for martial law, and eventually it's those emergency measures that are gonna kill it. When the Depression came, they just reached gridlock. We talked about Gröning last week, and Gröning finally he just couldn't do anything, so he set aside the Constitution and said, "Well, we'll just have to rule by presidential decree." He couldn't even make that work as a dictator. So the Weimar Constitution was put out of power by Gröning in 1931. And then his government fell in early 32. So he couldn't even rule as a proper dictator. It was so complex. And so gridlocked. So what happened was that a non-party government was put in, the Cabinet of Barons, and they called it that because two or three of them actually were barons. The man on the right in that, the foreign minister Konstantin von Neurath, was a baron, and the second from the left seated, that's Wilhelm von Geil, he was a baron, and Franz Papen, that famous German, was the chancellor. He's in between those two. And by the way, the man on the far left seated, that is Magnus Freiherr von Braun. That's Werner von Braun's father, who was in the cabinet of barons in the summer of beginning of the summer of 1932 and up to the end of 1932, or beginning of the spring actually. So that group took over, and to tell you the truth, they couldn't rule without the Constitution, with it or without it, either one. There was more violence in the streets. There were more communist threats, and gradually they just disintegrated. And the power, Hindenburg was the president, the old Hindenburg, and the power went to Hitler. So he was appointed chancellor in a coalition cabinet, and we can talk more about that later. I mean, the rest is history, right? And we'll deal more with Hitler in the question. So let's talk a bit about the Depression. A bit more about the Depression. I mean, we're talking about it all the time, right? I just wanted to put, you know, there's a bank run in Berlin. There's a soup line in an American city. I do want us to have the idea that this depression goes everywhere. And if you just compare some of those numbers we're about to see with the German case, you'll see that it's quite equivalent, especially in Germany. And in Germany too, there are some special conditions. For one thing, whereas in America, at least it's almost half agricultural by that time, a little less than half, but at least there's all this agricultural land where people could in fact grow their food. And as we know from so many eyewitnesses, including some in this class, I mean, people didn't really understand that they had privation. I mean, they ate simple food, but they had plenty of it and so forth out on the farms. But in the cities, people were actually, they couldn't grow their food and they had a lot worse time of it. Whereas in Germany, the agricultural sector was much, much smaller. The countryside was much harder to get to, and the cities, you know, just included much more of the population. So that was a tough thing. Same way with other European places. The cities were tough. So here are some unemployment statistics. I can't vouch for these. They're from the U.S. Bureau of the Census. You see that citation there, but we'll just take them as a guideline. So in 1929, you get about 1.5 million unemployed, and it goes up to 32. And of course, we get Roosevelt into power in 33. And these show these figures, which are, you know, sort of basic establishment figures, show that unemployment remains way, way high throughout the whole period. So it's we have these very, very high rates. Roosevelt had been in power a year, and it just hasn't gone down any appreciable degree, and so forth and so on. And you know, too, that Robert Higgs, you read his chapter, or if you read his chapter, if you read other works by Robert Higgs on all this, you know that that's the characteristic of this, that although there's a kind of myth that Roosevelt cured the depression in some form or fashion, in fact, it wasn't cured during the 30s or under Roosevelt. People were so frustrated, you know, they in America too. You know, I mentioned this earlier that there's that all these dictators around the world, people became a little bit accustomed to this, and the nation had this progressive kind of center left, or whatever progressivism is, magazine early in the Depression had an article, Wanted, a Mussolini. That was before they got FDR, right? Then they kind of had one. The FDR measures, everybody in this class knows these. I don't need to go through the whole list. The alphabet agencies putting people to work, the Civil Conservation Corps, and all the different work groups. So it would work on public works and building the, you know, roads and dams and whatnot. I should mention before this, I didn't include it because we read so much about it in our reading from the Great Depression. One of the myths of all this is that Hoover kind of did nothing, but in fact Hoover did a lot, as we've seen, and all of it was just a precursor to what Roosevelt was going to do. And Roosevelt was criticizing him throughout the campaign for, you know, his profligate ways and for not deflating the economy and for not all that. And then Roosevelt came in and really poured it on, much, much more of same in the form of all these kinds of measures. So the alphabet agencies, unrestricted, almost government intervention into the, not totally unrestricted, but extensive government intervention into the economy, the beginnings of a welfare state, the Social Security Act, much of the labor legislation, and so forth and so on, came as a result of this big crisis, as you know from Higgs's article and other places. You know that FDR treated the Constitution as a kind of administrative tool, and other presidents had done that before him, practically all of them, to tell you the truth, in one way or another. But, I mean, you can think of Lincoln or you can think of Wilson and so forth. But he made them all look like pikers. I mean, he made them all look like they really were amateurs at just treating the Constitution as a kind of means to an end, as a kind of way of administering people. And, you know, if you need to change it, just change it for the political purpose of the moment. The business connection that he developed, as I've said, were very much patterned on the corporatism of Mussolini. That is to say, he made a big show of you know, controlling runaway industry, but in fact, with the biggest ones, was on the best terms, arranging to give them contracts and so forth. Crony capitalism, as we say, or rent-seeking capitalism, as we often say in Austrian circles. And so you get that process going on very much. You get the favored few companies and the kind of centralizing impetus of the New Deal bureaucracy, which was smug and overweening and in every way detestable. And he carried out all the projects you'd think of, everything you can think of, the Italians doing building buildings or roads or bridges, the Germans building the Autobahn, which Hitler did as a public works project, setting up of swimming pools, making work for out-of-work photographers and whatnot. All of these things FDR did, and many of them were in imitation. Oh my, are there sound issues really? I just glanced down. Are there really sound issues or should I go on? We've had so many. Leslie Webb says she's okay. Mike Boyd's good. Cam says go on. Okay. Great. So you have this whole raft of measures. And so with Roosevelt too, and I mean the end of the story, you've already read it, the end of the story is that he didn't solve the Depression. He didn't cure the Depression. As we were told in grade school and high school and college over and over and over again. So if you repeat something long enough, then you know, it just becomes a kind of public truth. And you hear this in every conceivable form, and Roosevelt has taken on this patina. He's not at the level of Lincoln, that's for sure. But he certainly has a kind of, you know, second place in the hearts of the statists in this country. So let's leave the questions about Roosevelt, as with other questions about Hitler, for the Q&A. I want to talk about aggression a little bit. Not my own aggression, but the aggression of powers in the 1930s. And the main thing that we want to say is, I mean, we're going to talk about all kinds of conflicts, but the main big ones are the big war that the Italians had with Ethiopia, or Abyssinia, as it was sometimes called in the 1930s. In October 35, Italy conquered, Italy invaded practically the only totally independent African country left. The Italians had a piece of Somalia, and they used that as a kind of springboard to, you know, Mussolini wanted this African empire consisting of Libya and Ethiopia and Somalia and whatnot. And so there was an all-out, a big-time war, and Addis Ababa was, the capital was conquered, and Haile Selassie fled, and the League of Nations spoke out vigorously against Mussolini, didn't do much else. the British tutted because, you see, this meant an Italian presence, a bigger Italian presence in East Africa, and the British wanted to be in charge of all of that. But it's a piece of aggression. It's one member of the League of Nations attacking another. And, in a way you can say, well, you know, the League of Nations was a kind of fraud anyway. But on the other hand, you can say, look what a fraud it was. One member attacked another, and they just kind of said, well, let's have some sanctions here. Let's send them, you know, ugly notes or something. So there really wasn't very much done. I want to talk more about two other members of the League of Nations, Japan versus China. And I think this is important, and it comes into the whole American policy, which is the next couple of slides after this. So first of all, let me just back up. We've been through part of Japanese history, and I want to back up just a little and take a different kind of run and narrate something else from Japanese history. First of all, there's a Japanese versus Chinese thing going on way back from the late 1800s. There's a war against China. The Russo-Japanese War had Chinese implications. The Japanese, you know, Charles Tansel, whose wonderful piece of his wonderful contribution to perpetual war, you read, it was on the reading list. Tansel once said, you know, the thing is, the great powers had this poker game of imperialism going, and they finally admitted, Japan tried and tried and tried to get to be one of the poker club, and tried and tried, and finally conquered some stuff and got some power and built the navy and everything and won over the Russians. And so finally the imperial poker players allowed Japan into the game. And then when Japan got up to the poker table, the power said, hey, everybody, let's change to old maid. So that's kind of what they did. All the things that Japan was doing, Tansel's saying this, all the things that Japan was doing were the kinds of things that the European powers had been doing for 50 years, day in, day out, day in, day out, and had kind of done to Japan, except Japan sort of got over that and copied the imperialism of the West. So partly that's happening here. So Japan issued the 21 demands to China, which were all kinds of ways that Japan would be able to occupy and patrol and whatnot, and keep parts of China and to collect customs and that type of thing. Typical imperialist stuff. But this was in opposition to the U.S. open door policy, because our policy was always that vast wonderland of China where you could sell everybody one thing and become rich, that China had to be protected. So we call that the open door. It was really the kind of American access policy. Remember the Washington Naval Treaties of 1922 kind of kept Japan permanently at a lower level in the Navy. Another historical part of this is that Japan became a democracy, just like Germany became a democracy. Just like the United States was a democracy. There's a lot of democracies carrying out aggression here, I've got to say. 1927, Japanese army, which had been in Manchuria a little bit, and there was a constant sort of back and forth, but finally killed the warlord there and sort of took over Manchuria. There was a London Naval Treaty with all the powers. Japan was still in good with the powers in 1930. But a bigger army and a bigger invasion and a final invasion occupation in 31, Japan took over Manchuria and then called it Manchukuo and declared an independent country in 1932. So the League of Nations condemned Japan. They're going to condemn Italy a little bit later. But Japan said, well, we don't care. We're going to leave the League of Nations. Part of this was that the Japanese had begun to act on this idea of the greater East Asian co-prosperity sphere. You saw that in the Tansel article, if you read the article. And part of this was the Japanese were saying, you know, who needs all these Westerners? We've copied them, and now we're better than they are. We're going to have an empire of Asians. Now, it's true that we Japanese are super superior to all the other Asians, and therefore, why shouldn't we rule them? So we will have this empire where not everybody's going to be equal, but that's the way the European empires are. Not everybody's equal in those either, but at least we won't have the West running Asian affairs. So that's the Coast Prosperity Sphere, one of the great names in the history of government cover-ups of dastardly deeds with a kind of peachy-sounding name. So Manchukuo became independent, but actually a puppet state to Japan. And then Japan floated. I mean, you know, Hitler was out of the league too, and so they got together and formed this anti-Comintern pact. They both didn't like the Soviet Union. Then in 1937, the war in China starts up again, and this time in earnest, and this time pretty much continuously, with the Marco Polo Bridge incident. Then the Japanese used this little incident to invade China, and by the next year by the end of the year had reached Nanjing, and that horrific rape of Nanjing occurred. Over 350,000 Chinese killed, mass raping, torture, all kinds of horrible things. December 1937, the Japanese said they accidentally sank the USS Panay, and three Standard Oil tankers off of Nanjing. The Panay had been there. It was actually always stationed in China, because throughout the 1920s and 30s, the United States developed what was called the Yangtze Naval Service, where U.S. boats patrolled the length and breadth of the Yangtze River, fighting bandits and keeping in order all kinds of people who needed to be kept in order. So we had a whole arm of the Navy devoted to that service, and this particular ship was part of the Yangtze service. The Japanese said they'd done it by mistake. They apologized. They paid indemnities. Some people were killed. A few people were killed. Most escaped. But you can imagine it didn't go down very well. Japan captured Canton. Chiang Kai-shek was head of this corrupt coalition of Chinese armies, and it was a tough time. It was just about to, you know. I mean, of course, China's a big place. Japan had a lot more to conquer before it was all over. If we're talking about aggression, don't forget the Soviets, but it's mostly to their own people. But on the other hand, think of it, the own people of the Soviets are all kinds of different peoples within their already existing huge empire. So that's a kind of aggression that's carried out in the 30s too. So let me turn to United States kind of aggressions here for just a second, and just mention that we have the Navy and some army forces in China more or less continuously, with a few gaps, from 1912 to 1941 on occupation duty, anti-bandit duty, and whatnot, just about the whole time. All right? There are other powers that are also patrolling in China and keeping chunks and pieces of it, the British, of course, and others. But we have armed forces there carrying out our will throughout that period. We have wars going on, interventions in Mexico. You see the dates there: Haiti, the Dominican Republic. There was a brief intervention, an armed intervention into Yugoslavia to actually protect Italians from Serbs in Dalmatia, 1919. Guatemala, there's an intervention and short war. Nicaragua, there's jungle war and occupation and so forth that goes for over 20 years. Cuba, 1917 to 22. Honduras, El Salvador. You get the picture. This is it's it's not like the United States had a specific foreign policy anyway, even in the 20s, even under Silent Cal and even under Harding, who was the most, who spoke the most peaceable line of all of the 20th century presidents. I mean, he was basically an anti-imperialist. He was basically not in tune with all these things, but I mean, he inherited this massive complex and didn't have all that much time to work with it. But even under Harding, these things were going on. Well, let me move to FDR, and we're now on the home stretch. And I said I wanted to stop early and answer questions, but maybe we'll have plenty of time anyway. I just have a little bit to go. You read Tansel, you know how much he wants you to know about Alfred Thayer Mahan. Mahan was, what a guy, right? How do you like that picture? Alfred Mahan was a naval officer who didn't like the sea very much and taught at West Point for most of his naval career, and then wrote up a bunch of lectures on the influence of sea power upon history in 1890 and published it. And it was one of the most important books on naval or military history ever written in terms of its impact on people. The German Kaiser read this and said, oh my goodness, this is like a roadmap for us. Both Roosevelts read it and loved it. All the existing navies changed something based on this. So it had a tremendous impact. The gist of it was Mahan had become an enthusiastic social Darwinist. And in this particular sense, a lot of the social Darwinists, there's many kinds of social Darwinism, but many of the social Darwinists in the 1880s and 1890s began to develop an idea of big clashes. In other words, they say, well, these races in the past just had it out. So now we'll say that there were the humans and the humanoids, and they just battled it out in a big Titanic battle. And so they were kind of interpreting very marginal data to say, well, the way the world proceeds is big clashes. And Mahan bought this. He thought that the world proceeded by preparing for big clashes, and the most worthy races would survive the clash, would survive the Armageddon, right? And he said that the premier example of all this was the little British Isles, just a lot of rocks, some dirt, rains all the time, small area, an island, you got to get in the water to go anywhere, and yet they rule the world. So how does this happen? And he says it's because the people are vigorous and virile in that Darwinian sense, and they, from the beginning, they just tossed aside conventions like Henry VIII and built a navy. And then this navy, in a series of big clashes over the centuries, really beginning with the Spanish Armada and ending with, with Trafalgar against Napoleon, that the way it became supreme was to win out in these huge, big naval clashes. So that's the book. And that's what FDR read when he was a young man and got really excited about it. And all the time he was, you know, governor of New York, all those 4 years. That's the only real political office he held, elective office he held. He was Secretary of the Navy in World War I and said, oh, well, I better read something on the Navy. I mean, you can just hear him saying that, right? And so he read this book, and he was an enthusiastic guy. In fact, many people, many naval officers commented throughout the years that they really thought that FDR considered that he knew more than them because he'd read this book on him. You know, he read the book, and so he knew how to run the Navy. So that's why it's important that this is the background of FDR, because it's going to impact the 30s directly. Another aspect of American policy is going to be Henry Stimson and the Stimson Doctrine. Stimson was not the Secretary of War for FDR. He was actually Hoover's Secretary of War. And then later on, at the end of the 30s or the beginning of the 40s, he's going to become FDR's Secretary of State. He was influential the whole time, whether he was in office or out of office. And you can see by his pedigree there that he's one of those wise men. He's one of those ultimate insiders. He has all of the characteristics. And indeed, if any of you happen to read that article I wrote about the secretaries of war, he's the pattern of all the secretaries of war, including the Yale, including the Skull and Bones, including Harvard Law, including being an attorney and so forth, including Governor General of the Philippines. So all of these are kind of standard Secretary of War things. They're a special guardian class, I think. And in any case, that's his background. He has this elite Eastern background. And he comes to work for the government pro-empire, pro-army, pro-big navy. He's pro-Entente. He's pro-American entry. And he pushed Hoover especially for strong anti-Japanese policy. You remember we talked a little bit last week about American policy in the Pacific and how essentially they had settled on a fairly aggressive policy called War Plan Orange. Well, he was for pushing War Plan Orange to even greater heights, to even greater moments of aggressiveness. It was the influence of Stimson that got plans being made within the War Department, plans being made with the Navy, influential people interested in an anti-Japanese policy and a pro-Chinese policy. Tansel points out that the United States had much more trade with Japan than China, that there was much more investment, all of it. But there's this idea that the Japanese are the real danger and that they are the real enemy. Well, when the Japanese first attacked Manchuria, then Stimson said, well, look, we've passed this Kellogg-Briand Pact that meant that we renounce war as a tool of international relations. So what happens now if somebody does war, even against another member of the international community? Well, we have to disapprove in some way. So he issued what he wanted to be called the Stimson Doctrine at the very end, before Roosevelt was in, at the very end of Hoover. Hoover had been telling him no all this time, and Stimson issued it, I think, probably so that the new regime would take it up. It was a note to Japan and China in which there were supposed to be just simply non-recognition of any territorial changes made by force. And that FDR in Japan, that's a misprint, I think. I'll correct that and send it back out. But so we just don't recognize. And so for countries all across the world, it's our business to recognize or not recognize territorial changes, and we won't recognize them if that's the case. So it was a kind of anti-Japanese policy. And in fact, though he was out of office, the Roosevelt administration took that right up. In fact, Roosevelt had developed into quite a kind of super anti-Japanese guy. He had always been influenced by Mahan, who also thought that America would have to fight Japan. Mahan wrote another book about the United States and its Navy, and that was a part of the program. But in any case, FDR, from the word go, was ready to send the note to Japan, the Stimson Doctrine, fine. He created a naval program that was the largest expense up to that moment in the post-World War I world. It was $238 million to expand the fleet. That's about $4.2 billion. But that turned out to be chicken feed compared to what came later. 1935, it was $8.2 billion. That doubled again before the war started, and then doubled again. The Japanese, meanwhile, their budgets for their navies were going down. But beginning in 1933-34, they said, wait, what could the American fleet be growing for? We had this treaty with the Americans. They're five. The British are five. We're three. Those are our ratios. And yet they're spending all this money, and they say, oh, we're not making it bigger. We're just improving, but they're building ships. What is this? Why the secrecy? Why the, you know, the kind of malarkey here? This fleet that FDR is building could only be pointed at us. Moreover, throughout this whole period, 34 to 38, there were five different new editions of War Plan Orange. And you don't really change a plan that often unless the plans that are kind of just for the books, or, you know, you make a plan that's unlikely to be used, that stays in the shell. But the plans that you want up to date, those are the ones you're going to use. And everybody knew this. These were public within the government. The Japanese knew this. They knew that there were, they had spies enough to know that there were war plans being made. So it's a very aggressive type of policy. There's naval and economic pressure on Japan throughout this whole period of time. For example, there was another naval disarmament conference, one in the continuing a series from Washington Naval Conference to the London Conference, 1930, and then a 1935 conference as well. And on the eve of the Naval Disarmament Conference, FDR sends the fleet, and it is FDR. It's not, the naval commanders say, wait a minute, isn't this kind of aggressive? He sends the fleet to maneuvers to the west of Hawaii. Indeed, he suddenly changed the base of the American Navy from the American West Coast to Hawaii. In 1937, when the Japanese then attacked China full force again, and that's the beginning of the World War II for Japan and China, FDR contemplated a blockade of Japan and renewed hostilities. Remember, the American Navy is totally involved in the Western Pacific this whole time. We have a naval base in the Philippines, but we also have these many, many contingents floating up and down the Yang Tse. We have ships that patrol the coast, that put in all over the place. And then, of course, at Hawaii, at Pearl Harbor itself. So there was a new Army-Navy plan, not Plan Orange, but an Army-Navy combined plan in 1938 that was adopted for the case that Japan should attack without warning. In other words, they're going to cover all possibilities. You know, they were worried about the Japanese attack on the Russians in 1904, and they thought they might do it again. Well, everybody knew the Japanese might do it again, right? I mean, and so did the Army and the Navy. There were multiple movements of fleet elements at the express insistence of Roosevelt that Navy patrols go to spots where the trouble was, that they mixed in. Many of the admirals, one of them resigned, Admiral Richardson resigned, saying he just didn't want to be a part of starting a war. And yet these kinds of things kept on going. Much of this was at British urging, too. the British actually thought that War Plan Orange should not be based on putting all of the American forces in the Philippines or in Hawaii, but rather putting them all in Singapore to back up the British. There's a surprise for all of us. So there's all of this pressure, plus economic pressure, sanctions against Japan, eventually cutting off oil resources to Japan, eventually then tying up all of their all the money and freezing all their assets in the United States. And so we are, I think that's the last one I've got. We are at the end of our, what I wanted to cover for this time. And at least we're before 6 o'clock. At least I've kept it within the hour and a half. But But I do want to summarize here and say that this is that these are decades. I've talked about the whole period as a kind of design for further problems, right? And that I certainly would stick with that. And I think that what we see here is these problems developing and squishing together to create the horrible war that that came about just at the end of this period. So for next week, the last week, we have a lot to talk about: internal conflicts in Europe, the start of the war, and so forth. And so I think we're right where we want to be. And I will say now, let's call the lecture at an end and say that the lecture is at an end, and I will open the floor to questions and comments and all of that. So let me just troll up above and see if I can find a question up in the chat line. Then I'll look down below. Many of these are about sound and video. Let's see. There's a mustache comment. And Vangel Vesovsky says, wasn't the reason why Hitler could hang on to power, but Mussolini, wasn't that the reason? I'm not sure where we were in the lecture. The king simply dismissed Mussolini, and that was that, with Wilson insisting that the Kaiser resign. There was nobody above Hitler to throw him out of power without having to have a bigger army. I don't follow that. I bet you mentioned that when I said that Mussolini was, I mean, there was a moment when Mussolini was out of power before he introduced the Salo Republic and everything at the end, when he was temporarily, he was captured for, a while and had to be snatched away by the British. But it was never the firm kind of thing. I mean, Hitler had nobody above. Hitler was the head of state and the head of government. I mean, he was the Fuhrer, while Mussolini was not. So that's I think that's a good comment. Rod Huff says, I missed a few down here. Let me say. There's another comment about that. May have been only a one-star resort. I think so. Yeah, I don't think Sophia was down there. Actually, it wasn't. I'll tell you where Carlo Levy went. They put him in a little town called Matera, and this Matera was a place where the houses are actually carved out of caves, because it's a real soft tufo stone. And that town was what the Italians called, it had become so poor. Southern Italy was poor. I mean, it wasn't a place people, and it's still poorer than Northern Italy, but Southern Italy, especially that down right on the instep of the boot, it was very, very poor. And Matera is down there, not too far from the coast. And the houses were all kind of like cave houses, and a lot of the original owners had left, and squatters had taken up in that. It was a little bit like, Depression era squatters living in these places. And it was a rough kind of place. There was a lot of poverty and so forth. So this slick, urbane Northern Italian leftist writer went down there and did what slick, urbane leftist writers do. He wrote about it. But the interesting thing about that town is that after the second, that Mussolini shut it down. He said, this is a national disgrace, we'll just clean it out. So Matera sat empty for a while. Then after World War II, a lot of the original owners reasserted their rights and would go down there and try to clean up their rock houses and cave houses. And eventually, they, in the 1980s and 90s, they sort of got on to the idea of tourism. They said, well, wow, this is kind of a the striking place here. It's cave houses. So they started making it a kind of tourist destination, and they hit it big in the, I guess, in the 90s, whenever the Passion of the Christ was made, whenever Mel Gibson made that, he chose Matera as the main filming place. So all the scenes, just practically all the scenes in the movie that are not shot in the studio, they're outside in rock walls and all the that kind of thing. That's all in Matera. So now you can go and take a Passion of the Christ tour in addition to the rock houses and the pottery and cool local Italian food and whatnot. So anyway, I know that's off the subject, but it's a fun place. So there's something on my Rodduff says, in my public administration course in grad school, we read a book called To Run a Constitution, emphasis on run. Ha ha. It was basically a justification of the administrative state and its historical development, beginning with Woodrow Wilson's scientific management. You know, this is interesting, Rod. They used to say in Russian history, in fact, there's a good book, I'll think of the author in a second, on Russian history. He said, you know, the main thing is the Russians from the Mongols got this idea that the administration and everything else, constitutions and all government, is just a way to control people, and that there's no contract there, and that all Russian governments have just used government as a way to manipulate and control people, and the laws as a way to manipulate and control. But I've got to say, I mean, I realize that all governments have acted in that way. That it's only very, you know, it's you get some pretty short periods where governments are willing to adhere to, where the state is willing to adhere to its own rules. There are plenty of places we could point that out, but you know, I think it's often observed in the breach of it. So anyway, I think that's a good point. Yeah, how to run a constitution. Yikes. Stimson was Secretary of State, Secretary of War under FDR. Wait. Yeah. I got that backwards, Rod. He was Secretary of State under Hoover and Secretary of War under, I spoke wrongly. We'll have to go back and correct that somewhere. Okay. Do you think that the interwar years are a pivotal moment in how ethnic cleansing genocide plays out in world history? If so, why do you think this was? You mentioned in a previous lecture that you may be interested in taking a class on interwar years, ethnic cleansing genocide. Please sign me up. I would very much like you to teach a class on genocide through history. Yeah, I do think it's pivotal. And, you know, one thing that we didn't ever get to was this whole Lausanne Treaty recognition by all the powers that it was okay to ethnically cleanse two different places that the Greeks could ethnically cleanse themselves from all their Turks, and the Turks could ethnically cleanse themselves of all their Greeks, and they could just swap. So it's a horrible concept. On the face of it, it looks, well, you swap populations. But it's a totally anti-individual, anti-family, anti-tradition concept. So all these people have lived in, these Turks have lived in Greece, and these Greeks have lived in Turkey, and, you know, they have, you know, in many cases, hundreds and hundreds of years of history there. And then suddenly they're uprooted, their property's left behind, and they're just kind of plunked down. And so this is, you know, at the heart of modern ethnic cleansing. And that was agreed upon by all the allies, and it was smiled upon by the United States back in 1923 when the Turkish, the original Treaty of Sèvres was actually renegotiated in the Treaty of Lausanne. So they approved it. So when we get to Potsdam, and at Potsdam, they approve of ethnic cleansing on a scale never heard of before in human history. That is the ethnic cleansing of ethnic Germans from East Central Europe, from Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Yugoslavia. This ethnic cleansing took place with the total blessing of the Allies. The Allies were, in the end, they approved of, you know, more ethnic cleansing than Stalin, although, you know, they were a team and Stalin was on that team too. But yeah, I think this period all set the stage for it, and Stalin certainly set the stage for it. Hitler certainly set the stage for it. I mean, I think ethnic cleansing is just on a continuum with killing off people. I mean, you can, and that killing is one kind of ethnic cleansing. If you don't like this minority, you can drive them away, or you marginalize them, drive them away, kill a few, you know, whatever. In other words, there's a lot of ways to get rid of them, and I think it's all in the same kind of continuum. But yeah, I started to say fun class. It would be a very interesting class. It's all pretty depressing when you study it all at one time. But yeah, great. Maybe we'll do that sometime. Let's see. Vangel says, on the previous point about governing and bureaucracy, Mises makes the point that the bureaucracy and bureaucratic methods are ancient, and that must be used by all governments that rule over a very large area. Well, I mean, that's partly right. I mean, I think that the bureaucracy has to be the tool of the state. So that's an older kind of thing. But I mean, you know, in a way, in our Western civilization concepts and our concepts about rights and individuals and individualism, we've always, think about this, and you all know this, we've always talked about how the Romans set up the law of the 12 tables, and basically that was the first law as a contract idea, you know. And so this led to Roman law and the idea that law is a contract, and that the Roman Republic at least had this virtue that it was pushing law as a contract. You know, I got to thinking about this, years after I kind of learned that, I got to thinking about this in reading the exchange of letters between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams at the end of their lives, when they had, they had gotten over those years when they didn't even speak to each other and they started writing again. There's this great correspondence between the two, statesmen. And they get to talking about liberty and history and republics and history and whatnot. And they get on the subject of Rome, and Adams says, you know, I'm a little tired of hearing about Rome, because when I look back, all I see is state power and murder and villainy. I don't see much liberty. How about you? And Jefferson replies, I think you're right. I think there's less liberty there than people want to think. And meaning liberty in the sense of this law as a contract, so that if I don't do anything wrong, then the police can't come down on me. Well, we would think that would be the case in our country. And a lot of people naively still think that. But, of course, you know very well that's not really the truth. And I could say it's not really the truth anymore, but maybe it never was the whole truth. I think there were times when law was more of a contract. So anyway, I thought more about that, and I think maybe there's more to seek in the medieval period. Law as governance as property protection, governance as interrelated families, interrelated negotiated agreements, and so forth like that. And you know, that's interesting to me, because the very first writing that Thomas Jefferson did about the American Revolution was not a kind of current Enlightenment argument about natural law or something like that, a Lockean argument. His very first writing was about how law had proceeded to English-speaking peoples from the Anglo-Saxon councils, where they were agreeing on, you know, their local on local rural issue. Anyway, I'm far afield on that, but well, what the heck. So Leslie Webb says, FDR and presidents before him considered the Constitution an administrative tool, but until the New Deal, the courts did not. Yeah, that's true. I like Higgs' point that the New Deal made the courts and the Constitution subservient to the executive. Could you speak a little more about Chief Justice Hughes and his background? Did he regret the court's decisions under FDR? And unfortunately, Leslie, I don't know much more about him. In fact, when I was reading that, I thought, wow, I wish I knew more about that too. Yeah, it's, I mean, I've read that in the past, but I've not retained it. So I can't, I don't know more than we're just reading on the surface here. And so we'll have to save that. Maybe I can read up on it before next week, or maybe we all can. Let's see. But I love your comment up above that the until the New Deal, the courts did not. I think that's a very, very important point. Malcolm Arnold asks, did Mussolini try to unseat the monarchy, or did he think it was more important to replace the Constitution? Oh, I think he worked fine with the monarchy. The monarchy was quite willing to let him run the country, and it worked out fine. That was really no problem. Rothhoff says, agreed, Max Weber wrote about bureaucracy and influenced Mises. Yes, indeed. Weber argued that the more bureaucratic a society, the more conservative that society will be. Yeah, I think we could all read Max Weber more and with great profit. And his, this last writing he did before he was killed by the Spanish influenza, another one of those victims of World War I, was an address to the German nation. It is just a wonderful, wonderful piece of writing. It's like your readings, some ancient piece of wisdom. Let's see. Evangel says, to be a party to a contract, we have to agree to that contract. The problem with governments is that they impose a contract from one side. Absolutely correct. And we might have to look at Constant's distinction between ancient and modern liberty. Yeah, yeah. I've opened up a big bag of worms, but there are many, many issues here. I agree. But that contract thing is absolutely true. To be a contract, if law is a contract, somebody has to decide. If it's a contract and not just a decree, then it has to be agreed on by both sides. And of course, then you get all these fake ways of doing that. You say, well, Rousseau says, well, it's the will of the people that agrees to all that, or some other kind of fictional thing. I mean, nobody can measure the will of the people, right? So anyway, that's a very good point. Rod says, let me go down to the question and answer and see if there's any earlier one that I've neglected. Nathan's down here, let me just say, Nathan says, yeah, here's a good, let me just do this, and he's down here now, jump back up. Can you speak for a few minutes about what happened in Spain and Portugal during the years of World War I, why they didn't enter the war, and through the end of World War II? Okay, Nathan, yes, I can. Spain didn't enter World War I, and I think that the Spanish crown was so discombobulated and so rickety, and there were so many disputes and there was so much strife in Spain. One of Spain's problems was that it had not really modernized very much, and a lot of the old forces. A lot of the old fights that many other countries had fought in previous centuries were still not fought in Spain. And yet they still had nationalism coming to it. And so they wanted to be a Spanish nationality. But, of course, they had these other people in Spain who didn't want to be Spanish at all, the Basques, and especially the Catalonians. So they didn't go to war. Quite wisely, they remained neutral and thought, well, we'll just get a lot more out of this war if we just stay out of it, which is always a good idea. Portugal, on the other hand, only stayed out of it until 1916, and then Portugal did declare war. And so Portuguese fighters did go to the Western Front and other fronts, and they did fight in Italy as well. And so all of the things that happened in the other powers, because all the other belligerents in the war happened in Portugal, and I think that taught them a valuable lesson, because in World War II, they remained neutral, and the Spaniards also maintained a kind of, well, it was neutrality in World War II. Both sides had to play ball with both, and both countries had to play ball with both sides a little bit in World War II. And you're never quite sure where you were. And there were a lot of connections in different segments of Spanish and Portuguese society that were pro-Axis, other segments that were pro-Allied, and those things played out in World War II in interesting ways. But yeah, but Portugal did go to war and send folks to war in World War I. That's a good question. Rob says, FDR is on record admiring Mussolini. Well, I mean, he did make the trains run on time, right? And in Italy, that is, you know, apparently when people talk about that trains running on time, it sounds like a trivial thing to us, but of course, if that's the main way to travel, if that's the airlines and the trains and automobiles all rolled into one, and that's the only way you go long distance places. And we're talking about trains that were sometimes a day late. We're talking about not about 15 minutes late or 5 minutes late, but a day late. And so when Mussolini made those trains run on time, this was quite an achievement in Italian, considering Italian culture and the kind of, you know, mañana type, I know that's Spanish, but mañana type thing later. So, a lot of people admired him early on. I mean, he was a Time Magazine Man of the Year, just like, you know, many another, just like Stalin. But anyway, FDR admired him. I don't think FDR ever admired Hitler. He was dead set against the Nazis from the beginning, and I don't think there's anywhere where he admired Hitler. But he admired Uncle Joe excessively. Remember when people said, aren't you worried that Stalin's a communist? And FDR said, what does that matter? Some of my best friends are communists. Yeah, there's very much of a kind of admiration of Uncle Joe. And of course, later on, you know, just before FDR died and he went to Stalin, I mean, to the Yalta conference with Stalin in February 1945, you know, he was still trying to charm him and jolly him up even then. And people would say, but this is Stalin. And he'd say, well, you know, You never know. You have to do some hard thing. And Churchill would say, don't you get it? This guy's a kind of a murderer. And Churchill, at least, I mean, for all Churchill's multitude of faults, at least he brought this up to Stalin in different ways at the conference, talking about, you know, this group of people. Well, I hear you killed this many people in Ukraine, and Stalin would correct him on the figures and things. But Churchill never. I think he tried to jolly him up to the end, and he spoke. I think it was Churchill who thought that, Roosevelt, I believe, kind of considered him Uncle Joe to the very end. So that's how I would answer that. Let me go back up to the top now. And back to Rod Huss' question, he quickly made an interesting point about bureaucracy in ancient China and how corruption in the bureaucracy rendered the government less efficient while providing a buffer between the rulers and the ruled. That's interesting how that works. And different bureaucracies work different ways. And, you know, you think of the Mandarin bureaucracy that runs on some kind of principled basis and you know, you wonder how that might work in some other system. I do know this. There were times in the life of Prussia in the 18th and 19th century when that bureaucracy, which was quite a very highly organized, a bureaucracy full of esprit de corps and full of, you know, a sense of itself. And also, I was going to say earlier, I was about to mention Prussia as a place that that had a tradition of the law being everything. It's a total contract. I mean, you know, everybody, there's a famous story about this miller who didn't want his mill torn down by Frederick the Great and shook his finger in the great king's face. So, Yeah, it makes you wonder about these different bureaucracies. Of course, in our country, since our civil service has the great tradition of, you know, the Grant administration or something, where, you know, get as much graft and be as corrupt as you can, and devil take the hindmost. That, you know, it's a different kind of thing. It's kind of hard to imagine that sort of bureaucracy. Not that all bureaucrats are crooked, but there's a possibility that they are at any given moment. So, yeah, I think that's that is interesting. Okay. Malcolm says, Malcolm, I think this may be another one of those that we can talk about on the forum. It's a little bit far afield from our information here, but let me read the question and we'll see if we can tie it in. Can you speak to what extent the modern Olympics movement helped feed nationalism? Also, you know, anything about the connection to scouting and nationalism, especially internationally? Baron Pierre de Coubertin, who founded the International Olympic Committee, was also involved in scouting. He was a proponent of physical fitness education in a way to create a powerful state. Ah. In a lecture, you mentioned that Germany spent a great deal of money in swimming pools. That's true. Yeah, I think these things are connected a little bit. It's a big topic, though, and I've been thinking about other things. And so let's work on that in the forum. Can you just, like, copy that and put it in the forum, and we'll try to bat that around. And please, everybody who hears, you know, who's within my hearing of me right now, contribute to that discussion. That might be a lot of fun. and then Malcolm says to all participants, here's the Wikipedia places. And so, yeah, take a look at those. That's a wonderfully interesting question. And I don't know how I feel about the nationalism and all that. So, yeah, let's see how that comes out. That might be fun. Rod Huff says to all participants, it's interesting how Hoover, quoted by Higgs, compares FDR's closing of the banks to the Reichstag fire. Is it still disputed that the Nazis were behind the fire, deliberately set to blame on political opponents and create an emergency? Ah, good. There's a good Hitler question. So, yeah, well, the Reichstag fire, it's for a long time, it was considered actually a slam dunk that the SS or the Gestapo was part of the SS, that the Gestapo put this young Dutch guy up to it. And you remember, he was a communist, and they found a lot of communist literature in the Reichstag, and then the burning of it and everything. And it just seems ridiculous that anybody would go burn a building and then put communist literature in there if they were a communist. And then, of course, there's so the Reichstag burned down. And for those of you who don't know or didn't catch this in one course or another, the Reichstag fire is where Hitler, he was the head of a coalition government before that, and mildly working his way toward a dictatorship. But the Reichstag fire, that emergency allowed him to just take control, put all the parties out to pasture and take over. So that it was the Reichstag fire that was the sticking point. In fact, that's what took the Weimar Constitution totally out of effect. Although, this is an interesting point. We've talked about constitutions. Hitler never expunged or did away with or changed the Weimar Constitution. It was theoretically in power the whole of the Third Reich. So this kind of liberal, uber-democratic, social welfare, representative system, this was in power all the way through until Nazi Germany fell. But since the Constitution had these ways that you could create emergency decrees, basically they created a super emergency decree called the Empowering Law. And once the Reichstag fire burned, and said, oh, there's a danger that they're going to burn the Reichstag. What else will the communists do? And so this decree, in fact, it just set the Constitution out of force, as temporarily the assumption is. So that's a weird kind of paradox that the whole Third Reich took place under the aegis of a constitution that's not working, but it's still hovering out there somewhere. I think that's a brilliant analogy, because the closing of the banks, as Hicks points out, it was something totally within the choice. I mean, it was totally arbitrary kind of decision, and created that emergency atmosphere. So the question as to who was behind the Reichstag fire. Yeah, Rod, that's it used to be we all thought that the Gestapo put him up to it. But the latest information, the last few articles I've read about it, on the basis of some newly revealed documents, they do make it seem like the guy did it himself, like this was a total fluke thing but we don't know. We don't know I don't think we know for sure. But the latest articles make it look kind of like he did it. There's photographs of him during the trial, and I think he was drugged. His head is hanging down and all that. I think he was. They probably drugged him for the trial. But there's an idea there that that he actually did it. But I'll take another sweep through the literature and see if I can update that. It's like, you know, like going to a doctor, you want to read the latest literature, and I haven't checked on this in a couple of years. So let me take a look around the journals. Malcolm says this was on Lou Rockwell yesterday. It's an article giving you information about the Soviet buildup prior to World War II, which was offensive in nature, and how the Soviet weapons were the most advanced in the world, and they had the most of any nation. It's a really good article. Outlines new book part 1 and 2 with a follow up. Ah, that's exciting. It's right on our subject area. We should all read it. Excellent. Thank you. Let's see. Was Mises the first to show that fascism and socialism are no different economically speaking? Well, he's one of the first who pointed out all these similarities. I don't know that he was the absolute first. Does anybody else know of an earlier writer on these subjects? I don't know whether somebody else from, maybe even the Mises circle or another Austrian or somebody pointed this out. I don't know. He's certainly a very early one. And to tell you the truth, he points out these parallels, but you'll have a hard time getting a lot of people to agree with you on this. Because they just seem to think that fascism, I mean, these jokes, these great jokes where they say in capitalism, you buy a cow, you milk it, you sell the milk, and all that. In socialism, you are given a cow and you milk it and you share that kind of joke. That there are some different, the ones about the fascists, you buy the cow, it's confiscated, they shoot you in the head, and then the cow is shot, that kind of thing. There are some differences in a Marxian kind of socialist system or Leninist socialism and all the ways that these are run. And of course, Mises was talking about fundamentals, that there's a fundamental kind of state control of all the property and state control of intervention into your life and everything. So he's certainly the most brilliant early commentator I've read on this subject. So that's a good point. Leslie Webb says, German historian Ernst Nolte has argued that the radical policies of the right and Nazism in Germany developed in reaction to the famines and killing in Russia under Lenin and Stalin. To what extent did Nazi policies become more radical in response to perceived threat from Bolshevists and the dangers of what they would do if they came to power? Well, during that, when Nolte came out with this, and there was a huge argument in Germany, and it became a big public argument, and all the historians weighed in. And almost all of them said, oh, no, you can't say this. That's blaming the Holocaust on Stalin, and you can't do that. But I think Nolte had a really good point. I remember thinking when I read through all that I didn't necessarily agree with all of his points, but fundamentally there was this huge fear of Bolshevism and with real justification. You know, give you an example. When in Germany, a Bolshevik Russian sponsored group took power in Munich. In other words, they took over the state government in Munich. You know, they did what Hitler later tried to do in 23. They did this in 19. And then eventually they were run out of power. But when they were run out of power and the nationalist conservative forces and hard men, paramilitary forces, Freikorps-type forces, fought them to a standstill, they ended up taking refuge in a school, and they had captives in there. They had hostages in there. And at the end of it, they all died. All all these German communists who had, been trying to run Munich and Bavaria died. But before that, they slaughtered the captives, and they just mutilated them. I mean, they just tore them, the bodies to pieces, and stuck different body parts in mouths and things like that. I mean, it was horrible things. I've never seen this, but I ran across, I was looking for some photographs in the German Federal Archives photo archive one day many, many years ago, and I ran across these horrific pictures, and it was all a set of pictures. It was a set of pictures that had been taken basically on the spot at that school where the hostages had done. So, yeah, I mean, the horrific nature of the tortures and whatnot, Germans were kind of aware of this and aware of the brutality of communism. And Leslie, as you know, I put that right in the, right at the Bolshevik Revolution, the Leninist version of Marxism, the Leninist-Stalin kind of axis. I put that right at the heart of much of modern brutality. And I think that is part of it. In other words, that brutality drove other brutality. Think of Vietnam. Think of the ways in which the horrific, almost unimaginable brutality of the Viet Cong soldiers taking over villages, just doing things you can't even you shouldn't even think about. I mean, you shouldn't. It's hard even to contemplate. And then that makes everybody else brutal in return. So I think these things do certainly happen a lot. And I don't think Nolte was saying, and therefore Germans are innocent of the Holocaust. I think he was right on these essential points. I can't remember what I disagreed with him with, but I should look back at that too. The funny thing is, it's like juggling. You can't, you can't read everything all at once and remember it. So anyway, that's what I think about that. I think Nazi policies became more radical. Certainly Hitler thought that Bolshevism in its original essence was mostly Jewish. But then you may recall that that's what Charles Crane thought too. Remember the economic advanced man with Ibn Saud? That's what he told Ibn Saud. You know, he was that. So, because the fact of the matter was that Jews, because they were marginalized in Russian life, a lot of them joined all the socialist parties because they were allowed to. I mean, they were welcomed. And so the Jews were overrepresented in the early people's commissariat that ran the Bolshevik Revolution in its first year. So that's true. But you look at that. I mean, there's certainly an explanation for that. But a guy like Hitler looked at that and said, "See, that proves what I've said all along." which is in the strange thing about, you know, we get somebody who's Jewish like Mises, who's on the absolute other side of all of that, and many another like Murray Rothbard and many another who are on the absolute opposite side. And that could have been seen by Hitler or anybody else. I mean, you know, this kind of taking of the the whole Bolshevik movement as being represented by that this case that there were a lot of Jews on the earliest Council of People's Commissars. That's not being objective, right? Okay, let's see. What else have we got? It's 6:39. Are there? I bet there are more questions. Surely there are more. Are there more? Can you think of any more? Well, it may be 7:39 to you, but 6:39 to me, sir. I guess that's all in the perspective, Malcolm, you think? Let's see. It's subjective. Yeah, you're right. Subjective value. I guess it depends on your time preference, right? I just prefer Central Time. Anything else, folks? Shall we call it an evening? Yeah. I got a million of them, Malcolm, a million. Check the Q&A. Are there more down there? Okay. Oh, okay. Thanks, Nathan. What happens if Hitler is shot during the beer hall putsch? Oh, man. I don't know. You should make... Okay, Nathan. Here's my tip to you. I'm about to give you a lifetime of millions worth of dollars. You make a video game based on this premise. Hitler gets shot, and then what happens? And then alternate futures, parallel futures that spin out from that. You heard it from me, and I'd like not a lot, maybe 2% of the proceeds. And you know, we can sign something if you like, or just a handshake. So. Yeah, well, you know, you might say there'd be another Hitler, but, you know, I don't think there was another Hitler. There would have been some radical movement, but, you know, this weird, peculiar person who promoted these weird, peculiar people like Himmler, you know, there's no world in which you can see Himmler being in charge of much of anything. Except in the Third Reich, you know, and it's Hitler who's making all those decisions. And so, yeah, I think things are pretty different. I mean, I can't say that's all counterfactual, but if you make that game, we'll figure this out. We'll figure it out. All right. All right. Yes. Bit shake from here. There we go. Yes. Yes. You're on, Nathan. My main man. Okay. I guess we're done since we're reduced to this craziness. I think we're done, and I've had a good time tonight, and I'm glad the sound was maybe a little better. I hope it was. I hope the camera was better and the internet signal was better. And so thank you all. It was fun, and I guess we'll see each other for the last time next week, and that'll be fun too. We'll get into some really interesting things. We might go a little bit. We're far enough ahead. We might get it and scooch a little bit farther beyond 1939. You know, maybe we should get into 1941 just for argument's sake. Okay. All right. Well, see you next time. Good night.